Anime Pacific 79, this is, yes?
That's horrible.
I know, but I'm going to have to keep that.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to keep it. Yes, episode 79.
Very exciting, eh?
Yes, as we head into the chilly month of October. Winter is fast coming upon us.
Oh, please do, winter. Please do.
We were discussing before the show, in the last few shows, we have been throwing in anime stuff to keep our title relevant, but we're thinking now we should sort of make it more official, and like we have like a Tales from Aegisthus segment, we should have an official anime segment, and it won't be a sort of a column where we just throw out junk. It'll be an official sort of weekly segment. It's not going to be a slum penned off and ignored. It's going to be a key component because we are anime Pacific after all.
We are.
But we're definitely going to try to have something anime related every week, whether it's a review or anime news or something.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. I think last week we talked about ADV.
That's right, we did.
That's right. And this week we'll
This week,
discuss.
I will be reviewing the 2008 anime Aegis. Or was it Aegis? I don't know. Aegis of Uruk and Sword of Uruk. Both, obviously, from the Tower of Juaga, which was also a series of games. I'll be reviewing that today.
Yes.
Is that very exciting?
It's terribly exciting.
You can't contain yourself.
I cannot contain myself.
Well,
it's...
Share in Alex's excitement, you should hit our website, which is www.animepacific.blogspot.com, and also you can email us at animepacific@gmail.com, which is forwarded to our other email, which is anniepacman@gmail.com. But I think Anime Pacific is easier to remember, is it not?
That's right. Yeah, it is. This past week or so, my wife's parents are visiting from Japan, so we're planning on doing a lot of traveling, so I'm not sure how frequently I'll be posting on the blog, AniPack blog, so I expect you to take up the slack there, Skazebro.
Sure I will.
But it's busy times for us.
Certainly is. It's certainly...
You're looking at buying a new apartment, too, which is also very...
Yeah, well, there are several factors going into that that determine whether I will right now or if I will later, but it shouldn't really affect the show. If that's, I'm sure all of you are getting ready to tie a noose and hang yourselves, but if not, it shouldn't affect the show.
All right, at any rate, before we get to your anime review and our anime corner... as they would say in Japanese. I want to mention again this book series that I'm plowing into. Not the gore stuff. I after I finished that first book, I realized, well, I have the first four books in that gore series, but I'm missing book five. And until I find that book five, I figure I'm not going to fruitlessly continue and just sort of hang at that end of book four. So I went and I started rereading this amazing series, and I have not given it enough love on this podcast. I briefly mentioned it, but I want to make sure I mention it again.
Yeah.
And I want to encourage, just like I'm sure everyone listening by now has run out and purchased and or stolen the the amazing anime series Darker Than Black, I want everybody out there to run to their local library and or Amazon.com and read Steven Erikson's Malazan series. Book one is Gardens of the Moon. It's a fantasy book. And after, you know, switching from gore to reading this, you sort of realize either that the gore books are not so well written, or that this Steven Erikson is a phenomenal writer, creates just a fantastic world that's so rich and vivid, and you laugh, really humorous, wonderful characters. I cannot give it an high enough praise. 5 out of 5 stars. Let me give you a brief idea of what the story is.
Well, I just got to say, it must be good if it can sway away from Danielle Steele.
Danielle Steele, that's right. I don't read Danielle Steele. But
just for the Fabio covers, right?
The Fabio covers, yes, the bodice rippers. Yeah. That reminds me, my mom used to read those kind of bodice ripper books, and she'd have, like, we had a exchange student for a couple summers, and my mom was embarrassed by the cover, so she'd, like, wrap them in, like, these brown paper bags. But, yeah, anyways. Yeah, so the Gardens of the Moon, it's set in a it's a fantasy world with a sprawling empire covering several continents. And the empire is kind of fraying at the edges. Rebellions are popping up. The previous emperor was assassinated, and the first book centers around the Malazan Empire attempting to maintain their grip on this one of their three continents, Genbacchus, where their armies are trying to expand while sort of tamping down a rebellion, and the whole book is sort of centered around this one key city of the continent. And there are gods. Imagine sort of almost like a Greek mythology type of gods, where sort of mortals can become gods and can slay gods, and the gods are fighting amongst themselves and, you know, dying over the generations, dying, and new gods appear, gods fade out. They're, you know, yeah. It's almost like a Greek sort of style of you know, gods or religion, Greek sort of take on that. Interesting take on magic too, where the gods inhabit different sort of, I don't want to, different sort of fragments of almost like temporal stuff, you know, different sort of universe these gods inhabit, and the called, I guess, almost like planes in D&D, and the magic is taken from these different sort of aspects of these gods and the world they inhabit. It really, really well, really different take on magic and gods and politics too, and a lot of this stuff. Like, it doesn't start from the beginning. So when you get into, like, book one, there are all these sort of terms thrown out, and the history is kind of this world is sort of slowly kind of revealed to you.
Darker so, than black style, I suppose.
In a way, I guess. But the author was sort of has taken a little bit of criticism for this, but his sort of theory is, like, if you're going to set a book during the Roman Empire, would you have to start like in 700 BC where Romulus and what's the other guy?
Remus.
Yeah, Romulus and Remus founding the city of Rome. Yeah, Romulus and Remus. Would you have to start from
Harold Remus?
Would you have to start at 700 BC with them founding the city of Rome, or could you not start in 30 AD with the Emperor Augustus with the Republic risen and fallen, with Emperor Augustus already dead, with a rich history already having taken place and adventures to come. So he's taken that sort of same philosophy. He sort of set this book already, like, events have taken place that are worthy of their own series. Like, I'm sort of wishing, boy, I want a prequel, because there's so much stuff going on that, you know, that happened before the emperor an emperor took over, built this empire. He used to run a bar. So his the emperor was a barkeep, and he rose to build an empire, raised armies, and was assassinated by his barmaid, who is now the Empress. But was he assassinated? I'm not sure much I should reveal, but you sort of find out that he may have been assassinated, or did he find a way to become a god himself and one of the gods that rule the... It's really interesting. I highly recommend it. Steven Erikson, I demand linkage from you, Dane. Steven Erikson, Gardens of the Moon is book one of his Malazan books. Malazan Book of the Fallen, it's called. Really rich history spanning hundreds of thousands of years. I very highly, highly recommend them. So there you go.
Now, if they had a live action film of this, would it be conceivable to cast Kevin Sorbo in any role?
Well, maybe, I suppose. No, he's a bit old now, even though I know you love Kevin Sorbo.
He's not that old. He's still castable at various tough man roles. Preferably ones where he's covered in...
Well, you know, sort of strangely enough, I think it's impossible to do this with a live action. First of all, the books are so long. Any movie would not do it justice. And
HBO miniseries?
Even an HBO miniseries. I think like HBO is right now doing the miniseries with George R. R. Martin's Song of Fire and Ice books.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But even that is more conceivable as an HBO show than this, because this has such a... As epic as A Song of Fire and Ice is, this is that times 10 with the history and the backstory, the multitude of characters. Each book is like taking place on different continents. It's impossible. The only thing I could think of would be, and actually, when I'm reading the book, when you read a book in your mind's eye, you usually sort of picture, I guess, these people as sort of live action, real life people. Almost like a TV show you would maybe picture in your mind's eye. But in my head, I've taken to imagining these characters, imagining the whole thing as like an anime, believe it or not. And I could totally see this. And I should point out that this author is a Canadian. So in my... Well,
it's one strike against
my sort of... Well, in my... fantasy world, I imagine the CBC doing... buying the rights to this and doing a sort of Canadian-Japanese co-production and doing it. This is very... It can be a very gory adult series. This is not... not particularly full of sex or romance. Like the opposite of gore in a way, but very violent it can be anyway. So it would have to be like, I don't know, aired at like 10 p.m. or something. And the CBC could probably pull it off. But
would your dad watch it?
A Japanese Canadian no, too complicated. I should point out, this is very complicated. It's a complicated book. Again, they throw you into this middle of events in a way. So there's this long history of, you know, empires rising and falling. A new empire, this Malazan Empire, rose thanks to this one man and his handful of sort of heroes. And a lot of these characters who are like heroes have already died, you know, have been assassinated by this new empress. And there's no black and white character. Like a lot of the characters are shades of gray. I mean, there are no like true, like this guy's a good guy and this guy's a bad guy. There are just shades of gray everywhere. There are no clear good guys and bad guys like you would find in Lord of the Rings. You know, there's no Sauron. Everybody here is, you know, it's real.
Huh? Didn't Lord of the Rings happen?
Everybody has motivations. Nobody's purely good. Nobody's purely bad. Sure, there are incompetent people who are just boobs. They don't know what they're doing.
But do any of them make in breakfast?
It's not...
Okay, sorry, I'm ruining this, I know.
No, you're trying to add humor to my rant. So, Yeah, it's not Lord of the Rings sort of high fantasy good and evil. It's fantasy with George R. R. Martin style realism thrown in there, but very rich, very complicated, great history. You can really sink your teeth into it. And the other good thing, this guy releases books like clockwork, one every year. So nine of the books have already been released. There's going to be 10 in the series.
And how old is he?
Oh, the author himself? That's a good question. I don't know.
Yes.
I can tell you in a second. He was born in 1959.
Oh, okay. Well, he's still got a few decades left in him, so, you know, that bodes well. You know, barring
He only has to crank out one more book to finish the series. But he also, apparently, he created this, he co-created this sort of world with another author who is writing books that sort of fill in some of these historical gaps. So I mentioned this rise and fall, assassination of this emperor. These books written by another author who cooperates with Steven Erikson is sort of writing, has started writing books that deal with that, sort of side stories.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I hope, cool. Dane, I hope you take this recommendation to heart. I know you don't read books very often.
I read books all the time, actually.
I don't believe you.
I do. I read them on the bus, you big poo.
You're busy listening to your podcasts, I'm sure.
Oh, I usually get through at least one novel a month.
All right. Well, I haven't heard any novel recommendations.
Although I have to admit, I do like to stay consistent with what I'm reading. That means if I'm reading all the Robert E. Feist books, then I like to go through all of them and then start something afresh. But, you know, yeah, I'll check it out.
I don't believe you.
I like books. Make me sound like some illiterate douche, and I am studying a degree in literature.
You are not.
So I've got... I am! I've got books coming out of my backside. I'm doing Year 3 Shakespeare, Irish literature. I'm doing all sorts of stuff. I kid you not.
I thought you were doing a general studies degree.
The general studies degree is majoring in literature. And see, a general studies degree is very similar to an arts degree, except with the general studies, you can really... diversify your majors and minors. So, for example, my major is literature, and my other minor is communications,
and
my other minor is IT.
All right, you're a Renaissance man.
Oh my goodness, you're allowed to rant, but when Dane tries to rant, how
Nobody
dare
cares.
You?
Yeah, all right, fine. You're a Renaissance man. Anyway, so I sent you a link to this book one. I insist you read the book, Dane, and give me your thoughts.
Okay. Yeah, it looks good.
Okay, so I believe you. You're a Renaissance man. What are you reading now?
Well, I'm rotating between the Robert E. Feist books and, well, apart from my university required reading, the Drizzt books.
Okay, Remy D. Feist. I read.
Magician.
Yes, his famous.
I love
trilogy.
That book.
I don't
remember
now.
It was actually, it's one big book, but it's all also been broken up into three smaller books. I'm not sure which came first, though. Although the version I had was the...
I think you loaned it to me, actually. I don't even know
I think I did, actually, and I picked them up. I got them back when I visited you in Japan.
Right. Yeah, that's a great series, but I couldn't... Yeah, I think he lost his magic after that. I couldn't work my way through anything else he wrote. I remember... wanting to read that, because back in high school, this is, of course, early 90s, like even then that was like a sort of an old series. So we're going back a long way, but I remember a computer game came out based on...
Betrayal at Krondor, one of my favorite...
Betrayal at Krondor.
To this day, still one of my favorite RPGs. Oh my goodness, I loved that game. I read the book also.
Yeah, like I remember, but I remember somebody at, you know, in the dorm there, He was playing that game and was all excited because, you know, oh, this is based on the books and I'm, you know, these awesome books.
And it was canon and it was a new episode and it's since been adapted into a book again.
Oh, really? Yeah, I wonder whatever happened to, Yeah, well, anyways, yeah, so but I never got around to reading the book even after the computer game, and I never really played the computer game that much. I just sort of was watching him play it. But it's really sparked my interest. So when I went, when I ran across the copies that you had, I ate them up, and it was, I don't remember much about them. I remember them being great. But the Drizzt-do'Urden books, now, how far along are you in those books?
I'm up to about like the sixth book. Seventh book. I think I actually bought the box set. The problem with it is the first three are really good. Like those.
Yes, I just wanted to say that the first three are fantastic.
Yeah.
And then he gets to this mountain with those dwarves.
Yeah, and it's the same thing every book. An army of Underdark. Drows / yes. Black goblins / spiders is on the way to attack, and Drizzt must deal with his inner demons and background and face it and blah 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 blah. Yeah.
Yes, I could have told you that. Say, don't bother reading anything past the first trilogy because it's the same thing. You know why? It's because the author, you know, he had a contract with TSR,
yep,
or like the publisher. So he had a context for X many books. So, you know, so he just wrote out, he had the first three, and that was a huge success. He wasn't, of course, TSR makes all the money from it. He doesn't make a cent.
Yep.
So, you know, he's under contract. So he just cranked out the same story three times over.
Well,
just to complete his contract.
After the that sort of trilogy, it starts a new adventure away from the dwarf. And it's getting a bit better again. But, I mean, I'm not even a third of the way through of all the books there are.
Yeah, well, I suspect that he must have managed to negotiate a better contract or something. That's the only, you know, R.A. Salvador, you know. But apparently there are 18 Drizzt-do'Urden novels.
Wouldn't surprise me, yeah.
But I've only read, like, after that second trilogy... Maybe the last 10 are phenomenal, but after that second trilogy, where every book was, you know, he's with the dwarves, and an army comes up to attack. They're all the same.
Yep.
His blades are flashing. Yep. Now compare. I don't think I could, after reading, and again, the Stephen Erickson Gardens of the Moon series. I don't think I could go back to reading again Drizzt-do'Urden and the army of dark elves to attack. You know. It's
yeah, you know, actually one thing I always noticed about those books is it deals a lot with languages. So, you know, Drizzt goes to the you know, when he escapes from his dark elf place, Menzoberranzan or whatever it's called, and goes to the I can't remember what they're called now, the dark gnomes. He goes to the city of the dark gnomes, and He said that he could only speak some goblin, which is a guttural language. And then it's like, "And how are you on this fine winter's morn?" he said in guttural goblin. You know, they speak really eloquently, despite the fact that he said that, you know, I'm not fluent in this language. But, yeah, I thought that was funny. Anyway.
Hey, gang. Check out what other people have had to say about the Alpha Paddle podcast.
But anyway, it's all subjective, and
it's
pointless to argue about this. And then Kent from Upper Paddle will say, "Well, excuse me, but I think babbity babbity baba," and then it'll go on forever.
Yeah. Wait, that wasn't really that good. What else have people been saying about me? Kent is a prick.
Yeah, if you could, like, lock Kent in the bathroom.
Kent from Up a Paddle. Wow, I've been going for 3 years and that's the best I can do. But if you're morbidly curious or just can't get enough of anime, video game, or movie podcasts, check me out at upapaddle.com. That's UPAPADDLE.com. Or search for Up a Paddle in the iTunes directory. The Up a Paddle Podcast. Not really that good of a podcast.
Some of the early storytelling devices that I always loved in RPGs, I mean, some of them are so cliched now, like the you meet up with the princess and then you've got to fight to save the world from some outside threat or demon threat or alien threat or insert tier. That's pretty cliched. Or, you know, you're the boy, the farm boy, or the bumpkin who becomes a part of something epic, and that's another cliche. But one storytelling device I love, and this is often used in a lot of sort of roguelike RPGs and stuff, is that of the mysterious tower or mysterious dungeon. Only right. difference is one goes up and one goes down. I think one of the last great RPGs that dealt with that was the PS2 Wizardry RPG, which Wizardry is actually a West quote-unquote RPG, but it was very popular in Japan, so much so that they made their own Wizardry game. That captured the atmosphere of those sorts of things that I loved. You've got your sort of foggy, misty, depressed fantasy town and the great dungeon nearby, and you know, you go down into the dungeon, and of course eventually the game ends when you manage to get all the way down the dungeon and defeat the evil bad guy. Well, you know, I'd always play a lot of these sort of roguelike games where you've got the town and you've got the dungeon or the tower. And especially early on in my life, a lot of these were sort of text-based or ASCII-based.
ANSI.
Yes, ANSI. And so a lot of it was left up to my imagination, which is fine. I do love the earlier games that help to stimulate your imagination. And I like to think I'm a person of a certain degree of imagination, and what does that mean?
Nothing. Continue. There's a tentacle sex.
Oh yes, okay. I was. That's what I thought you were. That's where I thought you were heading. But anyway, the whole narrative device of mysterious dungeon or tower hasn't been used that much outside of the computer game or video game world, and it just so happens that there is one such anime that was made just a year ago that actually deals with this storytelling device, and of course it is in fact based off, believe it or not, an arcade game called The Tower of Druaga. And they adapted this game, well, I wouldn't even say adapted, because it's not really a straight adaptation, it's just sort of based on it. Not only is it based on it, but it's based on what it represents to people now, which is, you know, sort of a retro, pixely kind of memory to a lot of people. And this anime is, at least for the first half, very much in touch with its retro roots. And I'll explain that a little bit more later on. But the first series, of which there are two, Aegis of Uruk, or Aegis of Uruk, came out first. And yes, it is a gonzo show. And if you've listened to any other podcasts, you know that Gonzo Studios kind of doesn't have a very good reputation amongst a lot of people.
Notorious.
I wouldn't say notorious, but if you look at the body of works, there are a few things there that people hold in high esteem, such as Hellsing, Full Metal Panic, Kid Igrade, although I was never into Kid Igrade myself, Samurai 7, Desert Punk, Basilisk, which I absolutely loved. Basilisk, I loved it. Speedgrapher, which I actually also absolutely loved. It was just so wrong in so many ways. No, when I say...
Wait. You have to elaborate.
Well, Speedgrapher is basically a superhero show except each of the people, each of the villains, their superpower is dictated by their sexual fetish. So, for example, there is one dentist who gets a sexual fetish out of inflicting pain and taking out people's teeth. So his power is that he's got like all these, almost like tentacles, these flying kind of electrical, dentist tools and devices and stuff like that. But anyway, yeah, I actually really did enjoy Speed Graph. I should probably review that at some time. Gankutsuo, The Count of Monte Cristo, which I, believe it or not, I've never seen.
Well, the newest thing, Shangri-La, which I've seen the first, like, 7 or 8 episodes of that, is another Gonzo show. And I've been meaning to review it, but I've been sort of waiting for you to get... watch a couple episodes.
Yeah, I will. For those of you that are wondering, I'm actually finishing off Macross Frontier, and then I'll move on to something new. But suffice it to say, I mean, Gonzo have pumped out some crap, and a lot of their reputation...
G.I. Joe, Sigma 6. I didn't know they did. I mean, look at their... They did a G.I. Joe animated series. Whoring themselves out for the Americans.
Yeah, well, they also made Afro Samurai, which, you know, I hated. And, you know, they have made a lot of stuff that's given them the reputation of having a great beginning and a very bad ending, which I can certainly see some examples of that. There you go. Speed Grapher, whilst I enjoyed it throughout, it has the greatest drop in, just from a purely aesthetic point of view, in quality of any show I've ever seen. Because the first episode of Speed Grapher, the animation is theatrical. It's just fantastic. If I, you know, you'd put that on a big cinema screen and people would not, you know, they'd compliment the animation. It's just fantastic. But then after the second episode onwards, it looks like it's, I don't know, a Hanna-Barbera cartoon from the 70s. I mean, it's just a huge drop in animation quality. And for the final episode, they sort of ramp it up again. But there is, no matter whether you like Gonzo or not, there is one person in Gonzo who is an anime director who usually works with Gonzo, who's called Koichi Chigira.
Well, before you go, I want to talk more about Speed Grapher. So this is a total tangent. I'm sorry for interrupting. But I'm looking at the Wikipedia site of the Speed Grapher. And I got to say, the box art on the DVD looks very intriguing. So I don't know. I know you can't really judge a book by its cover, but I like the look of that. Is it worth watching or not? I can't really tell from your mini review there. Look at this box art. It's
I really liked it.
For our listeners, there's a young sort of teenager, sort of typical Gonzo fashion. They probably call her 19, but she looks like she's
12.
She
is actually, she's 15 years old actually.
Yeah, okay, she looks 10. Yeah. You know, he's got a lot 5 years off. It's like in that Shangri-La, there's a supposed like 18 or 19 year old with constant like fan service, but she looks like 12. Okay, anyways, and behind her is a she's holding a camera, and behind her there's a sort of a roguish looking fellow with a shirt sort of open with a trench coat and money all around her. Sort of swimming in a maelstrom around them. It looks really intriguing. So,
well, I think it's unlike anything out there, I can say, and I enjoyed it. It's definitely for over 18s. You know, it was a TV show that pushed the buttons in many ways. That's my opinion. It's been a few years since I've seen it, but I will review that in the future.
Yeah, okay, maybe a future show, because this is really great. I'm going to put this in my to-watch pile, but then again, it's a Damon recommendation, no offense. You're kind of shooting 50%, at least in my taste, anyway.
Well, judging by your tastes, I say it could go either way for you. You could really love it, or you might not, so...
Yeah, it has to pass, like, my kind of... my, I guess the test is the will I bail test, and if I watch the first couple episodes and I bail...
You know, going off on another tangent here, you were talking, you reviewed Monster and you said how it went on for and how you didn't like that part of it.
Oh, if I had my druthers, I probably would have bailed, but my wife, like, I don't know, liked it, but she was sort of... I don't know. She got. Yeah. She wanted to finish it, so I got suckered.
I do love stuff of a slower pace, anyway. So I enjoyed it obsessively throughout. But what I did hear on the Geek Nights podcast quite a few months ago was they were saying the same thing as you, yet they loved the manga, which the anime is actually a straight up adaptation. It's almost totally the same. However, they said that part of the skill of the mangaka was that. They were able to pace the manga in just a perfect way that flowed from page to page. When you're reading it, it just flows so well and it goes at exactly the speed it should. But when that sort of technique is adapted to an anime, it just doesn't work. That was their opinion. That's why they thought...
Well, that's a very clever comment. I wish I had thought of that for my review.
Yeah, well, you know, you didn't read the... You haven't read the manga, so, you know, you can be forgiven for that.
Yeah, that's true.
But anyway, so moving on, yeah, I was saying that Koichi Chigira is an anime director, and he's directed stuff generally has been looked at very favorably, or at least has a pretty rabid fan base, which includes Full Metal Panic, which, you know, obviously that's...
I don't know, people love that
They
show,
do love
I,
it.
I'm not...
I haven't seen it, believe it or not.
I can't quite figure out... Neither have I. I can't quite figure out why, just judging from its...
Mecha mixed
cover.
With high school hijinks, I guess, is it?
Yeah. It looks, I don't know, very kind of average to me. Yeah. I cannot believe it's...
Yeah.
But then again, what do I know? I mean, So much stuff people like that I can't quite figure out.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what was that show? Japanese anime that got really great reviews, but was it Gasaraki?
Oh yeah, Gasaraki. Well, you know, you gotta that's
that was it.
Yeah, you just got to understand modern anime audiences. They're into the pretty boys, the, you know.
That was so overrated, that Code Geass. People have such crap taste. They got no standards at all.
Yeah.
There's an example of a backstory that was an opportunity wasted. They had this great theory of a British Empire that goes on. But such an opportunity for a brilliant backstory flushed down the toilet, unlike Gardens of the Moon by Steven Erikson.
Okay. Yes, okay.
Continue on with
yes.
your...
Yes, okay. Well, this director, he's also directed Gatekeepers, which I haven't seen. I think Gatekeepers isn't looked at, you know, as with a terribly... doesn't have a terribly big legacy. Last Exile, which a lot of people loved, and Brave Story... which was what I reviewed in my infamous review in episode 3, where I was still trying to learn how to review for audio, and I actually just gave up and swore in the middle of it and forgot to cut that out. But Brave Story...
Yeah, we gotta get rid of those first three episodes, man. We gotta put them on like a different feed or something so people stop like...
You're absolutely right. So...
The only thing worthy of that whole thing was our Robotech discussion.
Oh, yeah, you know, there was some good stuff in there, but, you know, it was very raw, especially the first episode. Oh, the audio quality, just terrible.
Oh, and it got, like more than, like, 2,000 downloads or something.
Yeah, that's right.
It's depressing.
That's right. Oh, I'm up for a new anime podcast. Ooh, what's this? Ooh.
Yeah, people, like, dive. I guess it makes sense, because when I try to find it, first podcast, like a show, I usually go to the first podcast.
So do I.
That's a huge mistake. We got to get rid of those first three episodes.
That's not just a mistake for us, but for any podcast, I think they'll...
Well, you know that podcast that I recommended to you, that gaming podcast?
They removed their first episode.
You know. Yeah. Why aren't we that smart? Why haven't you deleted our first episode?
Yeah, maybe I should. But anyway, moving on. Brave Story was another fantasy anime, and from an aesthetic point of view, It has a lot in common with The Terror of Druaga because the character designs are very similar, the colour palette, and of course the director and the studio. And as I said, it's the first time I've really seen a proper adaptation of the ever-popular gaming concept of the mysterious tower or the mysterious dungeon. And you can probably guess it by the title. And it's set in this giant tower, which mysteriously popped up before, and the tower is awash with beasts and different monsters and goblins and stuff. And there was a famous king called Gilgamesh who went to the top. He wasn't a king at the time. Gilgamesh is actually who you play in the video games.
Sounds familiar. A
lot of this is taken from Sumerian mythology. You know, Gilgamesh was the great giant, I believe. A lot of this has stuff in common with Sumeria. There are lots of Sumerian links, if you know anything about the Sumerians in history. Gilgamesh went to the top, defeated the monster.
How did you know he was Sumerian? You looked on Wikipedia just before I did, didn't
you? No, I didn't look at Wikipedia. I bit about... You know, I'm quite interested...
BC.
I'm quite interested in... you know, BC history, and Alex is really into the Romans. I've always been more into the sort of the. I've gotten into the
Greeks.
Romans. Yes.
Because you're like poo pushers.
I suppose if there's anything I've been interested in, it's the Three Kingdoms period of China and the Mongolian Empire, which you know,
Mongolian Empire is just depressing.
Oh, they did some good... Well, okay, we're digressing so much during this view. This mysterious tower popped up. The king, before he was a king, Gilgamesh, went to the top, vanquished the evil monster, and became a king. And throughout the decades that followed, the tower started to get settled on the ground floor, or sort of within the tower. There's lots of monsters... covered in this tower, so the bottom of the tower is the only real safe place because they cleared out all the monsters. But every few years, the tower, the monsters are normally just almost invincible. It's almost impossible to defeat them. But every few years, something magic happens and the monsters get a lot weaker, and that's when people go in there to seek their fortune and try and get to the top. And the tower itself for the first season is just utterly fascinating. I loved the design of this place. They had this real sort of underground city in the tower, and the way it was done was... I just found it really fascinating. And the show starts out in such a way that it's basically a cliched parody, yet in some ways it summarizes a lot of the show, and it's sort of basically a dream, a very sort of berserk, over-the-top kind of dream, and it lets you know that this show doesn't take itself too seriously. And I think from that point of view it does a good job establishing that fact. However, it might put a lot of people off, because the first time I watched the first episode I thought, this is insane, but I'm kind of wanting to see a fantasy anime, and I just kind of abandoned it, and I didn't get back to watching this for another few years later. And the second episode does change, you know, drastically. It the first episode is really love it or hate it kind of an episode. It's not, you could even not really necessarily watch it, and you wouldn't miss anything.
It sounds like an anime that I'd watch the first.
Yeah, well,
and
don't
fail.
Watch the first episode then, if that's your personality. But the second episode onwards, you see, now my baby's utterly distressed at your insult. But from the second episode onwards, basically the main character Jill wakes up, and all of the first episode was a dream he had while he was knocked out by a monster, and he's with a few other travelers, one of them being his brother, his half brother or twin brother, half or twin, what the hell's wrong with me, he's it's his half brother, and his half brother is called, what's his name, Neba, that's right, Neba. And Neba's traveling with two other people. One is called... okay, I'm screwing this up. He's with one
you can,
blonde chick, one...
You can cut all this out.
Yeah, he's one giant knight and this archer. Now, I remember the archer's name. He's called Kali. Utu, that's the name of the big giant knight. And he's totally masked for the whole first season. You never see his face. And, you know, whenever he's nervous or something, there'll be a giant sweat drop, although he's wearing a giant mask. Basically, they're carrying this guy who's called Jill, who's the main character. And Neba said, you know, Jill, you shouldn't have got involved in this. You're just a nincompoop. And he says, we're going up to the top of the tower by ourselves. You can stay here in the town. And they dump Jill in the town. And Jill's really depressed because he is the guy that says, oh, I want to be the hero. I want to...
Is it Jill or Gil? I can't imagine a guy named Jill.
I'm pretty sure it is Gil, but it's spelt with a J. In fact, I'm almost certain it's Gil, so I'm going to call him Gil for one.
It's got a... Thank you. Odd. Yeah, okay. Yeah, you threw me there for a second. Okay.
But yeah, he's basically fired from the party. So he wakes up again in this town, which is at the base of the mysterious tower. He's taken care of by this lady who is called Kaya. And at first, Kaya is kind of the somewhat dopey healer. This all has your cliché, deliberately so, I should mention, has the clichéd characters, the healer, the paladin, the defender, the thief, the warrior. So Kaya...
Yeah, I don't know. See, unlike Gardens of the Moon by Stephen Ayer.
But this is kind of done on purpose. And Amy, who is this stoic redhead female warrior, and she sees something in Jill that obviously his own brother couldn't, and she said, can you help me get to the top of the tower? She has her own reasons for getting to the top of the tower, but Druaga is at the top of the tower, by the way. And then they recruit two other people. Melt, who is one of my favorite characters, he is this kind of this guy from a wealthy family who fell from grace. He's called Melt, and he's this mage, but he's kind of funny because he's got these golf clubs, and each golf club is a different spell, so there'll be like a ice arrow golf club, and he's got an assistant, Cooper, who is this 10-year-old, basically like a maid to this guy. And it should be noted that Gonzo released a cuddle pillow for this character, Cooper, where she's wearing her underwear, or she's wearing a schoolgirl uniform and her butt's poking out and her underwear's there, and it's good for otaku to rub their genitals against, but she's 10 years old, people.
And you're perching this
pillow. Oh, yes,
pillow
I'm
right
rubbing
away.
Against it as we speak. She's 10 years old.
I believe it.
And Gonzo authorized the... Yeah,
that's very
disturbing. Although for the pillow,
and knowing Gonzo, she's 10 years old, but she looks.
No, actually, I was just about to touch upon that. The pillow, for the pillow, she looks like she's about 15. There, she looks pubescent. So suffice to say, I won't be purchasing this pillow. No, well, I won't be purchasing it no matter what she looks like. But she's always scolding Melt. You know, she's basically the maid, but she has a lot of power over him. And none of these people, except for Ami, who is the stoic redhead female, none of them are very competent, or at least they're what you would call low-level in RPG terms, and they brave the tower by themselves. And this is the part I love, because I wish this would have gone for 100 episodes in this format, but they get higher into the tower, which is filled with mystery, you know, dungeons and just strange things that you wonder why they're there, and they encounter different traps, sometimes done for comical effect. Like, there was a trap, this is probably one of the best traps, they encountered this trap that turned them into 8-bit pixels, so they look like the game that they're based upon, and like 5 minutes of it is all done in pixel. There was another one that changes their sex, so it gives the guy big jugs, and he naturally, like any guy would, he's more concerned with watching his breasts jiggle than actually finding a way to cure the problem.
So it's a comedy.
To an extent, it has an uncanny...
See, I don't know if I can
Well, okay,
that.
Then listen. It has the uncanny ability to alternate between serious comedy and a mix of both throughout the first season. So, you know, you'll get some episodes that are kind of hilarious and some that are very serious, especially towards the end of the first season. Naturally... the other party, Gil's brother Niebuhr, their party is also making their way up, and they're the elite kick-ass. And there's lots of other little parties going up there, which I suppose serve to be the ensigns of Star Trek. You know, they get themselves killed and remind you that this is a pretty dangerous trip. But what fascinates me is just the different... places they encounter on their trip to the tower, because, you know, one of the things about this storytelling device is once you're further up, you come to a point of no return, and it kind of adds to the excitement. And the tower itself is a very interesting, at least for me, creation. There's one other city up there, because one of the other characters is a knight, or a group of knights who work for King Gilgamesh, whose job it is to colonize and the tower, so they sort of send a whole army up there and sort of push further up there. So there is another town up there that they visit, and some of these characters are kind of minor in the first season and they become bigger in the second season. But basically, lo and behold, Gil becomes a lot stronger, so much so that he begins to rival his seemingly invincible brother Kaya. And they get up to the top. They see Druaga, and
should you be spoiling like the whole?
No,
season,
I'm not spoiling anything at this stage. Basically, as there's two seasons, the fact that they get to the top of the tower in the first season is not a big spoiler in and of itself. And the second season kind of says, yes, you got to the top of the tower. But was that the real top of the tower? Or was that the real tower itself? So the second season begins, which is a lot more... is almost completely serious, except for the first three episodes. It's almost completely serious, which, I don't know, doesn't suit it to an extent. I think I like the first season better. And I also didn't like what they did with the tower in the second season, which becomes less of a physical tower involving dungeons and cellars and mysterious rooms and denizens to kind of a metaphysical place, the tower within your mind. It turns out that they're in the shadow mind of the King Gilgamesh, who...
Well, you're really spoiling stuff.
No, I'm not. Believe me when I say I'm not. King Gilgamesh, and it's alluded to very early on, there's something amiss with him, and that's what's dealt with in the second season, which culminates in a battle which will affect the entire world. The second season is good in that it involves a lot more political machinations that were absent from the first one. It's a lot more serious. I like it how some characters die throughout the series, and they really do die, and the characters that were minor become bigger. I mean, that smells of epic to me. Just like I was mentioning, the knight that was involved in helping to colonize more of the tower becomes a bigger role. There's a certain betrayal, but I won't say who. And basically, it takes place a little bit later. And some of the characters are kind of different, they're changed, and I really like that aspect to it. And overall, while I think the second season suffers a little bit from its serious nature, I think overall this was a series that I enjoyed a lot.
It looks like there's a lot. I'm looking at the list of characters here. It's huge.
Yeah. There are a lot of characters. And like I said, the story kind of ramps up towards the end of the second season. And I enjoy it for a lot of things. I enjoy it for finally seeing my imagination come to life, you know, what these kind of dungeons look like. I enjoy it for the fact that, you know, characters do die. Main characters do die. They betray each other. It's quite realistic in that sense. And I enjoy it because it has an honest-to-goodness ending, which is just a rarity in anime these days. You know, they think... or they give you a half ending, because, you know, you never know, there might be more. And this does open the doors for more, but it gives you a very definitive ending also. So I personally really enjoyed this. I haven't seen a lot of fantasy anime, and I do like the genre, and I think this one did right by it.
You haven't seen a lot of fantasy anime? That doesn't sound right.
Well, there. I mean, compared to what's out there.
All right.
But overall, I really enjoyed this, and I think you will too. I mean, it's up there on YouTube legally.
Is it?
For free. This was...
I'm looking for pictures of this Koopa chick. She does look young, although when I typed it in, I seemed to get a lot of perverted pictures, so it's...
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Well, you know, there's several... there's also the blonde magician chick who has a much more prominent role.
Fatina, I guess is her name, is that right?
Yeah. Athena is the she's the associate of that knight I was talking about, Kelb, who also becomes a bigger character throughout the season.
But I guess the key point, I don't know if we made this clear, that this is a video game from like the early 80s.
Yeah.
And it was remade not 20 years ago, but this is a recent show, came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So expect top quality animation.
Yes, that's one thing. The quality of animation is fantastic throughout. There is no noticeable dips in quality at all throughout the series. I still love the second season, but not as much as the first. So while we always say that Gonzo starts off excellent and turns out really bad, this is not the case, but I can see that the first season is second season is still good. But regardless, I didn't like the second season as much overall. But, you know, this was famous because it got simultaneously released legitimately worldwide through Bost TV, Crunchyroll, YouTube, and of course Japanese TV. And I believe Funimation has the license for this, and I don't think they've released it yet, but it's certainly worth a purchase if it comes to Blu-ray. Yeah. So,
all right.
The Tower of Druaga, Aegis of Uruk, and the Sword of Uruk. Sword of Uruk is the second season. Good fantasy anime. Check it out.
All right.
That ends another stellar episode of Anime Pacific with a review that attempted to be coherent, but we also mentioned things like Yale and different novels throughout. But
yeah, that might have been my fault.
Anyway, in a nutshell, I did enjoy that show. So.
Yeah, and if you like the video game Diablo 2, it sounds like, or Diablo 1, it sounds like a good old-fashioned dungeon crawl.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like I said, I do enjoy that narrative, especially when it's right. I mean, if it's a sort of a perky, safe place, it's not as interesting. But if it's the mysterious kind of town, and you know, you got to venture off into the dungeon, and you know, I just like the atmosphere that
right
that goes into those things.
So check out that show, and I absolutely insist that everybody listening read Steven Erikson's Gardens of the Moon, book one of his Malazan series, M-A-L-A-Z-A-N, Malazan series.
Sounds like a kind of a medication.
Not
for
not
chest infection, I take Malazan.
Yes. Yeah. So those two things in everybody's homework.
Okay. And I should mention that I did say that I would review Junk Boy, and I still will review Junk Boy and post it up, but I'm just fixing a little error in the file. The audio's a bit out of sync, so I've got to get that back into sync, and once I've done that, I will review the classic OVA Junk Boy. So rest assured, it is on the to review list, and it hasn't been forgotten.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't quite follow you there for a second. So you're saying the actual video you're trying to fix?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Just a bit of an audio out of sync.
And, all right. And in further podcasting business, we insist that you email us.
Yes, we insist.
AnimePacific@gmail.com. And check out the website, animepacific.blogspot.com, and post in the comments section now with Discus.
Yes, that's right. We are there on Discus, and we got a good response the first time, but people are getting a bit lazy, or it might be because I posted the episode not on a weekend, I don't know, but get off your ass, people, come on.
That's right. Okay, and yeah, so until next time, balcony's
closed. Bye, buddy. Bye.
See you later.